And we are rolling. Hi, Matting.
Hi, Mark, how are you?
Good. So this is Mark Goldberg with UN Dispatch coming to you from the United States of America, and I'm speaking with
Mading Ngor from Juba, the newest capital, the capital of South Sudan.
The newest capital of the newest nation on the planet. And there's actually a lot to talk about. I'm really glad that we're able to speak. You're a journalist down there, or up there or over there, as I should probably say. So there has been a lot of tumult in South Sudan since the birth of the nation a couple years ago. But in recent months, it seems as if, from where I sit, following news events about what's going on, that there has been an uptick in violence in one part of your country, in Jonglei State, and that has caught the attention of very senior policymakers here in the United States. There was a New York Times article just a couple of days ago saying how the National Security Council is now hosting very regular meetings on the unfolding situation in Jonglei. Can you maybe sort of set the scene for us and let us sort of know what's happening, what the background is, and why people are so concerned?
Thanks once again for having me. I am delighted to speak about Jonglei. Coincidentally, this is also where I come from, the state where I was born. Jonglei has been witnessing a simmering violence. It didn't start after the independence of the new country, which gained its independence from Sudan in July 2011, so just over 2 years. And before that, thousands were dying in Jonglei. The problem is attributed to cattle raiding and inter-ethnic violence between ethnic groups. I believe that the causes are deeper because you have areas that are previously marginalized. There are no opportunities, no education, no services, health services. So you have a state which is impoverished by the long wars that have gone on there. And so these issues that we are seeing, the inter-ethnic violence that the New York Times was referring to, is something that has been ongoing for a while. It has been concerning because in the run-up to the referendum that brought about the independence of the new republic, there was concern from the wider international community about the instability in the state. And, you know, analysts wondered whether that instability will not spill over to the rest of the country. And, you know, it triggered concern about the viability of the new republic. So it has been an ongoing thing. It's a simmering violence that has unfortunately taken and needlessly taken lives of thousands of people. The state that we have is a weak state. The government we have is a weak government that is unable to intervene everywhere. And by weak, I mean you don't have, they don't have infrastructure in place. So even if they have, you know, the army, they are not able to intervene in these inter-ethnic conflicts that have been ongoing. The disarmament was attempted by state government in Jonglei many times, and it never usually works because this is not so much about taking the gun away from the people. It's about addressing the needs of the people, giving them opportunities so that they can lay down the arms and so that they can abandon these nomadic lifestyles that is common in those areas. So Jonglei is a concern, is cancer in the neck of the new nation, but it has unfortunately not been solved. So it has added, the situation as in Jonglei has added to the increasing fragility that we see in the new nation.
And there are about 100,000 people that have been displaced by this communal violence, by this interethnic and tribal violence. But I guess what's really concerning from when I talk to people at the UN is that it's the accessibility to this region from a humanitarian perspective is really, really difficult to achieve. I think partly because of the geography, but partly, as you said, because of the infrastructure. There are no good roads there. And, you know, they're warning. I think I saw like a MSF, Doctors Without Borders report warning that people are just sort of hiding in the jungle and sort of completely off the radar of any humanitarian agency. And then on top of that, over the last couple of months, there were at least two incidents involving UN peacekeepers being attacked and ambushed, and in one case, shot down over the skies. In Jonglei, trying to sort of deliver humanitarian assistance there. So it seems as if just sort of getting to the people in need is a desperate problem.
It is a very remote area, and what compounds things is the fact that you have a rebellion there, rebellion that is going to months, and the rebellion is fueled largely by the ethnic Morle and the Morle youth. The Morle are the ones that are found in Pibor. And then you have other ethnic groups. They are a minority, and the narrative that is emerging, the narrative that we read about, is that what is going on in Jonglei is pitting a big tribe, the Nuer, versus the Morle. But what we have, there are two things that we are seeing. One is that there is a rebellion that is fueled largely by the Morle. And secondly, you have violence that is taking place between civilians from the other tribe, the Lor Nuer, and the Morle. So you have two conflicts that are raging at once. The rebellion is being dealt with by the army. But the way it appears as if the entire army for the new nation is targeting what is an ethnically, what is monolithically, morally rebellion. But I don't think that is the case. The army is dealing with the rebellion, and then there is another conflict on the side which they are unable to handle. Civilians are butchering themselves, and the government is unable to intervene because the government says, or the army says, there's no way we can intervene in this civilian conflict because we already have this conflict we are dealing with. Overall, I think it comes down to addressing the root causes of the problem. Nobody takes up arms for no reason. And, you know, the government time and again has been saying extending amnesty, unconditional amnesty, to the rebels, but they haven't been able to take it. So what we are seeing is a case where the ethnic Morle people were naturally marginalized, and the rebellion is further marginalizing them. It is uprooting the civilians. So if this conflict can come to an end, the two conflicts, the civilian one is on and off, so it never stays year-round, but is on and off, and it is something that persists. So you have a government that is unable to accord protection to all civilians, is not able to intervene when civilians kill themselves.
It seems, you know, like the long-term solution are things that are inherent in sort of state building and nation building, right? Like what they call security sector reform, building up a proper military and police force and a proper justice sector to impose for rule of law in hard to reach and in remote areas. But that's something that takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of political pressure and attention from the international community, because this is something that sort of I think a country can't do on its own, a new country can't do on its own, that needs a lot of help from the UN, from other sources to do things like train the army, police, judges, lawyers. But that's like a very long-term process over the course of many years. What's your take on what the short-term outcome of this sort of conflict that currently, I guess, is just localized to Jonglei? I guess, how will that affect the development of South Sudan as a country, and what do you think is going to happen in Jonglei over the next sort of few months?
Well, you put it well, Mark. This is not an isolated conflict, or this is not an isolated case. It's part of the larger weaknesses that we are seeing in the new state. It's a new state, and I emphasize that point. And it is just beginning to address all these challenges. This is the reason why South Sudanese took up arms. They took up arms to be able to solve these challenges. So these challenges were inherited, but there's no longer any excuse for not dealing with them, because we now have our own economy, we have our own government, central bank, our own army. So it is, I think the government should be able to deal with it. How do you deal with it in the short run? I believe the main thing is to end the rebellion, and the world should pressure the rebellion that is going on there, the leaders of the rebellion, to end the armed struggle. We don't believe that taking up arms is the best way of dealing with the situation. We have tried it, and millions have died, even though at the end of the day we were able to get our own independent country. It was very costly in terms of human lives. So ending the rebellion is the first step, and the president, Salva Kiir, said, and even a few days ago, he reiterated that, you know, he is open to welcoming the group unconditionally so that they are part of the nation building.
So I wanted to maybe ask you maybe a broader question. So, you know, as you just said, after something like 20 years of civil war against the sort of forces in Khartoum, the new country of South Sudan was birthed 2 years ago this summer. And, you know, I reading the news reports and sort of following the story at the time, there was this great expression of hope and optimism, as I think is probably naturally the case if you've been sort of fighting for independence for so long and finally you are independent. I'm wondering, though, if those feelings have tempered now that sort of the reality and the hard slog of building a country from scratch that had very little infrastructure, that had been at war for 20 years, has sort of dissipated, and what sort of the general mood, if you can put your finger on it, is like in Juba today?
It is true to say that independence dividends have not been delivered. There are many reasons for that. Some are internal, some are external. You have a situation, when this new nation was born in 2011, it had an economy, it inherited an economy that was over-reliant on oil. On Independence Day, South Sudan was 98% dependent on oil. A year on, the oil was shut down because Sudan and South Sudan, Sudan is the country South Sudan broke away from, had issues to resolve. Now, South Sudan is a landlocked country.
It might be worth pointing out that South Sudan has the oil, but North Sudan has the infrastructure to export the oil. So it's an uneasy
South Sudan
sort of alliance.
That's correct. South Sudan is landlocked, so South Sudan relies on Khartoum to export its oil. So in January 2012, South Sudan felt that it was being cheated by Khartoum, and its oil was being diverted and not being taken to the international market for exports. And that happened 3 months in a row. A political decision was made by the government in South Sudan to shut down the oil. Now think about a situation where you are shutting down 98% of your income. And for the last 15 months of independence, or 2 years of independence, this new country has been operating without oil. And the progress that has happened is that as a result of the shutdown of the oil, the government has been able to increase its taxation collection. And up to now, they can say that 10% of the economy, that 90% is dependent on oil, and they have made significant progress in collecting taxes. Now, how does this fit in the context of the conflict that is going on and the challenges that we are going on? the new government is unable to assert its authority without any money. And as we speak, there is a lot of uncertainty. And again, the uncertainty is on both fronts, both internally and externally with Khartoum. Khartoum has given South Sudan a firm deadline. There's 2 weeks. So August 22nd, if there is no resolution, which is being brokered by the African Union, to resolve some of the sticking points between the two countries, then oil can be shut down again. And that is going to have severe impact. The other front I was talking about is the internal front. And the audience and yourself, you have been hearing about what is going on in the Republic of South Sudan. The president, Salva Kiir, has dissolved, or last week dissolved his government, dismissed his longtime vice president, Riek Machar, suspended the secretary general of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement Party, and also the chief negotiator, or was the chief negotiator with Sudan, Pagana Amum. So this situation triggered a political storm of uncertainty, and soldiers were deployed heavily across the streets in Juba, and fear gripped the capital. Nobody knew what was going to happen. There was fear of violence, but the fear was averted. So the situation is fragile. What triggered this? That is a political wrangling within the ruling party. The vice president was dismissed because he has intended to challenge the president in a convention, and he's essentially been operating in a campaign mode, which his boss never liked. The secretary general was also blaming the ruling party, saying that the ruling party had failed. So we are seeing a very fragile system on both fronts, externally with Khartoum. If the oil is shut down again, God knows how this country is going to survive. There is talk of borrowing from the internal pool, the internal private sector, which I believe has nearly been exhausted, because in the last 2 years, the government in this country was relying on the private sector in this country to be able to maintain the core functions of the government. So will they be able to borrow externally? Will they be able to rely on the donors to be able to run the government? So whatever challenge that is going on right now cannot be solved without solving the issues of the economy. You have an economy that is not diversified, and people talk of going to the agriculture. People are talking about another route. Export another route to export the oil to Kenya, but all these options that we are hearing about require money. So where is money going to come from? So the country is going through a critical period. This is a transitional period. I believe there is no political instability yet, but there is a lot of uncertainty about where this new nation is going. It's a country that has since its birth, pledged to follow a democratic path, and the United States of America and its allies has been able to support this young government to follow the path of democracy.
I wanted to ask you that, about that, because you laid out sort of a series of really deep and fundamental challenges facing South Sudan, but I wonder if you think that one thing that South Sudan does have going for it is the fact that sort of a lot of people in the highest levels of the U.S. government really want it to succeed. There are people, I'm thinking about Susan Rice, the new National Security Advisor, who are, very much like help midwife South Sudan. They were there from the start, even during the Bush administration when they were out of office. They were part of a group of people that were really strongly encouraging South Sudan's independence against against Sudan. And now that they are in high places of government, Samantha Power is another one. Gail Smith in the NSC, who I've interviewed here on Blogging Heads, is another person where you have really like a coalition of really top-level officials who are strongly supportive of South Sudan. So, you know, this is a poor, landlocked country in the middle of Africa, but it's not ignored by any stretch by the United States. So I wanted to say, how do you see that relationship affecting the prospects of South Sudan overcoming these challenges that you described?
I believe the United States of America, some high officials are committed to South Sudan. You spoke of the National Security Advisor, Susan Rice. We can also talk about John Kerry. And, you know, the president of this country, Salva Kiir, wears a cowboy hat, a trademark cowboy hat, and that was given to him by John Kerry. By John Kerry. And he wore it when he declared the independence of the new republic. So there is a lot
My
of goodwill.
Understanding is that that hat was given to him by George Bush, but I could be wrong.
No, the initial one was by George Bush. And the
one. And John Kerry gave him another one. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, okay. That's correct.
And if you see him, he wears this when he's like at all international forum. It's pretty awesome. He'll address the UN General Assembly wearing this big black cowboy hat. It's pretty impressive.
That's
correct. Go on. Yeah.
So there's a lot of goodwill from the United States of America for this new nation to succeed. We also see it in the operations of the USAID. You know, this is an agency that has been able to construct the longest highway connecting South Sudan with Uganda. The government itself has not been able to do that, but the United States of America has been able to do this for the new republic. So there is no question about U.S. Wishing the new nation well. But it also has to pressure the new nation not to leave the democratic cause, not to violate civil liberties. And we have been hearing about violations of human rights, and, you know, and journalists have been constantly on the run. And so I believe, you know, the policy of carrot and stick can work if it is used in equal measure, but not more carrots and less of a stick.
It's sort of a complex relationship, as you said. I wanted to maybe ask you also about the relationship and sort of the hostilities, because there still are somewhat open hostilities between South Sudan and Sudan along the border region for the last almost 2 years now, for several months at the very least. The government in Khartoum has been almost replicating strategies that they used in Darfur, but along the border regions of Sudan and South Sudan, to sort of almost purge ethnicities that were politically aligned with the South from inside their own borders, and are creating a really desperate humanitarian situation in the Nuba Mountain regions in particular, which is not catching sort of the international attention as much as, say, Darfur did, but is still a very desperate situation that's causing instability along the border. Are ordinary South Sudanese, say in Juba, sort of feeling the pain from that? Are they like, how do they sort of understand or appreciate or interact with sort of the border conflicts that are happening, like in Abyei and in the Nuba Mountain regions?
Well, the situation that is the conflict that has been raging in Sudan, in the Nuba Mountains, in southern Kordofan and Blue Nile, as you have clearly outlined, those areas were previously aligned to the south. But as soon as independence was obtained by Southerners, they went to Sudan, and we remain in South Sudan. But what happened, they were part of the army. They were part of the main army in South Sudan. They were a division. And as soon as South Sudan broke away, they separated. They took all the armaments, and basically the situation there was addressed in the agreement that eventually brought independence for South Sudan. So they had right or popular consultation that they would be able, they would be consulted, and they will be able to say where they will belong, whether they will join the new republic or they will be part of Sudan. Sudan never waited for that process. It ended the process, and what happened? The conflict ensued, and that conflict has been used to undermine the new state. And the constant arguments or accusations are that South Sudan supports the rebels in Sudan against Sudan. I cannot confidently speak to the kind of support, whether it exists or not, but I know it is an issue that has been milked by Sudan to undermine the new republic. And Sudan, more than the internal challenges we are witnessing in South Sudan, poses an existential threat to this new nation because we are unable to get, you know, our source, our lifeline, which is oil. Our lifeline is oil, and because of the conflict that is going on in these areas, we are unable to have oil. Inflation has been shooting up in this country, and regular folks in the capital can barely get by. So that is one way that conflict affects the new nation. And mind you, the conflict in Blue Nile, Southern Kordofan, and even Darfur, because they have joined an alliance, is holding the future of the new nation hostage. So I don't see a prosperity taking root in South Sudan without resolving what is going on in the Sudan. Audience would... go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
The audience would remember that Sudan was part of a whole, and part of the strategy on the side of the now the ruling party in South Sudan, they called for something called New Sudan. New Sudan vision was a vision where Khartoum is transformed into a democratic state, and everybody would be accorded the right in a federated system. Eventually, that vision was not achieved, so the South separated and became its own country. So the resolution, the resolution of the conflicts in the Sudan is key for the survival of this new nation.
Yeah, I mean, so the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Accord that eventually led to the referendum, which led to the independence of South Sudan, also called for the democratic transformation of Sudan itself through national elections. That clearly hasn't happened. I'm conscious of our time because I know that it's going to take like half a lifetime to upload this video on your end. But I wanted to ask you one more question on the oil front. You know, when I was talking to people around the time of independence, they said, you know, both Sudan, both Khartoum and Juba have too much to lose from a resumption of hostilities that would result in closing down the oil exports. Like, there is a lot of money on the table that Khartoum is giving up by refusing to export the oil. It seems, though, as if even this great incentive of all this money on the table is sort of not enough to keep oil off the table from a point of conflict between the two countries. I'm wondering sort of, I guess, why did you think that failed? That vision that like there is too much to lose from stopping the oil exports.
You are right that the two countries are dependent on the oil that is exported from South Sudan. It's a matter of degrees. I don't know who is going to blink first in case the oil is shut down. But the reality is that both countries need the oil to get the economies going. But I think there is a legitimate fear on the side of Khartoum that if the more you pour in oil resources to South Sudan, there's a propensity to spend it or to support the rebels. It is a legitimate concern, but it's not always the case here because this is a country that is beginning from scratch. You don't have the roads. you have health conditions in, you know, health, the health facilities are barely functional, and even the soldiers in this country are barely being paid. So I believe the two countries should not antagonize each other. We ultimately have to realize that for the two countries to survive, that has the hardliners have to be tamed, and you know, we have to remember that the future of both countries is what we should work towards. That mutual viability is what should we, what we should be supporting. And the two countries have enormous ties, cultural ties, economic ties that bind them together. So it is a difficult question to answer, but I hope in the end, within these 2 weeks, the hopeful thing here is that the oil was supposed to be shut down on August the 7th, but it was extended for another 2 weeks. So the hope is that the African Union High Implementation Panel will be able to broker some kind of agreement that will ensure the continuity of the oil exports, and the viability of the two countries, two viable countries, will bring peace to the region and to the world.
Well, Madding, thank you so much. That was really interesting.
Thank you very much for having me. Bye-bye.